This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Repeated attempts to repeal and replace Obamacare have failed so far, but amid political uncertainty about the future of health insurance, premiums are going up. Just how much those premiums are going to increase may not be entirely clear to many consumers. And the future of health insurance beyond next year is also murky. So are you looking to buy health insurance on the government exchange beginning next week? How much are your premiums going up? What questions or concerns do you have about health insurance? You can reach us at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can also send us a tweet at WMFE Orlando. I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. And let's just hear a little bit of President Trump. Here he is talking about the Affordable Care Act at a cabinet meeting earlier this month.
As we meet, Republicans are meeting with Democrats because of what I did with the CSRs, because I cut off the gravy train. If I didn't cut the CSRs, they wouldn't be meeting. They'd be having lunch and enjoying themselves, all right? They're right now having emergency meetings to get a short-term fix of health care, where premiums don't have to double and triple every year like they've been doing under Obamacare, because Obamacare is finished. It's dead. It's gone. It's no longer, you shouldn't even mention, it's gone. There is no such thing as Obamacare anymore. It is and I said this years ago, it's a concept that couldn't have worked. In its best days, it couldn't have worked.
President Donald Trump talking at a cabinet meeting a couple of weeks ago, but maybe those rumors of the death of Obamacare are a little bit exaggerated. Health insurers say not so fast. Navigator Ann Packham speaking to 90.7's Abe Abariah just a little bit earlier.
There's a lot of confusion. We had people calling us on Friday saying, you know, what should I do now? Should I enroll for next year? Is this going to affect my care like next week if I'm getting a procedure? And what we're telling people right now is really the law hasn't changed. The Affordable Care Act hasn't been repealed. You know, nothing really has changed other than the shorter open enrollment period. So get ready, re-enroll, look at the options. We actually will have more plans in Orange County than last year.
That's healthcare navigator Ann Packham talking to 90.7. Well, here to sort us out, to help us sort out some fact from rumor, is Tony Jenkins. He's the market president of Florida Blue. Tony, thanks for coming back.
Absolutely. Thanks a lot.
We're also joined by Jody Ray. She's the director of Florida Covering Kids and Families. Jody, thank you so much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And Abe Abariah, 90.7's health reporter. Abe, thank you.
Happy to be here.
Well, Abe, let's start with you. One thing up for us. When does open enrollment start and end? Because the time period is a little bit condensed, right? But
So open enrollment starts next Wednesday. That's November 1st, and it runs through December 15th. And there is an extension, though. So if you live in a county that has had a disaster declaration because of Hurricane Irma, you can continue enrolling through December 31st. A lot of the people we're talking to, though, were saying, you know, you probably should go ahead and try and get your enrollment finished up by December 15th, though, just to be on the safe side. That gives you insurance that'll kick in January 1st, 2018.
Mm-hmm. It sounded from what we heard from Ann Packham that things are a little bit chaotic, though, from the point of view of consumers. What's your sense of whether, you know, what's been going on politically might convince some people that they can't actually sign up for health care under the Affordable Care Act this year?
Well, it is an extremely complex topic, and I follow it regularly, and it's difficult for me to keep on top of it. And so when you start throwing around terms like cost-sharing reductions, subsidies, these different things, and then you have, you know, the president saying, you know, Obamacare is finished, it's done, you shouldn't even be using the name anymore. There is a lot of confusion out there for people who maybe are, you know, not paying attention to this full time. But now is the time to kind of come to it. You know, it's open enrollment season. It's the time to kind of look at your plans and figure out what's going on. So it is an extremely confusing time, but, you know, it's sort of the trigger time now.
Mm-hmm. We got a comment from Terry Miller writing in on Facebook. She writes, I think people haven't been paying attention if they aren't worried about their health insurance premiums going up. Terry writes, I've had to buy my own policy since 2011. Even though I'm quite healthy, my premium is $633 a month for my son and I. So clearly some concerns from folks, and some of these concerns go back quite some way. If you have some concerns or questions about your health insurance, we'd like to hear from you as well. You can give us a call at 1-866-338-5252. That's 1-866-338-5252. You can send us a tweet as well. We're at WMFE Orlando. Jody Ray with Florida Covering Kids and Families. It is a shorter enrollment period. How are you folks handling that?
Yeah, it's a shorter enrollment period. So what we've done is really make sure that we're ramping up our navigator teams on the ground. Are covering Florida. Partners are cover Pensacola to Key West. And we're also got a pretty diverse communications effort to get the word out. I think most important is to get on people's radar is the open enrollment period. Mm-hmm. We really don't want people to be caught off guard by the shortened open enrollment period. And I have some real concerns that could be something that would be off their radar. We want people to be prepared to review plans. We're encouraging people to come in and look at plans, even if they have a plan right now, just to make sure that the plan that they have still meets their needs, mm-hmm. fits their budgets, covers the kind of care that they may need, and also not to wait until the auto-renew kicks in at the end of the open enrollment period. We want to really make sure that people have an opportunity to review the new plans that are out there.
I mean, people can sometimes put things off, right? And healthcare being so big and so complicated, I guess there might be a sense of just, you know, trying to push it out as long as possible. What have you found in previous enrollment periods? Have people waited till the very end of that kind of window to sign up?
Well, I would say that December 15th window has traditionally been, you know, as we got closer to it, you could really see a peaking of activity with that. I mean, we tend to get much busier going into that December 15th, and people are really trying to hit that January 1st coverage date.
Mm-hmm.
I think last year with the scaling back of some of the communications, I think a lot of states really saw a slowdown. It didn't push the urgency out there so that people made sure that they didn't miss the end of open enrollment, which is unfortunate. And I think a lot of states actually, and, you know, we saw it slow down here. We still managed to enroll, you know, in Florida, more, you know, about 1.7 million people and still saw an increase from the previous year. But I have a feeling that, you know, some people may have missed out the open enrollment period. Mm-hmm.
Jody Ray with Florida covering kids and families there. Abe Abariah, what are your thoughts there? What are you sort of hearing on the ground as far as how people are approaching the shorter enrollment period?
Well, I mean, one of the things to keep in mind is even with if you factor in the extra 2 weeks for Hurricane Irma with, you know, December 31st being the cutoff, you still have an entire month shorter than the year before. So, I mean, one of the things that I'm hearing concerns about is, you know, particularly when you have people who are younger, they may be putting this off. You know, January 1st kicks in. They might go, oh, I need to figure out that insurance. It's supposed to kick in today. And, you know, the enrollment period's, you know, too mm-hmm. far gone at that point. So there is some concern on that end of it.
Tony Jenkins, market president with Florida Blue, what would be your sort of biggest concern? What's the biggest thing that you want to clear up confusion about heading into this open enrollment period?
Well, as Jody and Abe mentioned, there's been a lot of conflicting and confusing messages out there. So we want to make sure that individuals are making sure to reach out to the right channels
mm-hmm.
And become educated and know that here's the time now, a condensed time, to make sure that they've got coverage going into January. So we've tried to make sure to point people to either our retail centers, healthcare.gov, agents. The biggest thing that we want to make people make sure that they know is that the marketplace is still there.
Right.
Some folks have assumed that because of the president's executive orders that Obamacare is being impacted now and that they cannot have individual plans or subsidies. So we're trying to make sure that folks know if they had a subsidy last year, premium subsidy or cost share reductions going into this year, a lot of that is not going to change from a cost standpoint. Mm-hmm. And a lot of individuals don't know that.
I'm going to take a call here. We've got Laurette calling in from Orlando. Laurette, you're on the air. What are your concerns or questions about the Affordable Care Act this year?
Well, I have to say, I'm a business owner, mm-hmm. a self-employed person, and I have, when I first came to Florida, I was on the Affordable Health Care Plan.
Yep.
although, and that was the first year, and although it was a little difficult to get started, I found it an excellently comprehensive plan, having had an insurance license in the past.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the period being reduced this year for enrollment, it wouldn't be so bad if the funding wasn't taken away from the advertising that it has previously had.
Mm-hmm.
The administration is confident in saying that it's failing and it's this and that because they're making sure at every point that they take the legs out from under it. So we could even deal with the reduced, with the increased challenges of the reduced enrollment period if we had the proper funding to the advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a key point that needs to be made to people who are considering still having the plan is if you don't have insurance at all and you go into a facility, they can charge you their top rate. But if you have any level of coverage, even the smallest level of insurance, even if it doesn't cover what you've gone in for, they can't charge you above the allowable rate. So even if you're getting a plan that's not giving you everything, you're getting some protection from being charged the top rate.
Laurette, thank you so much for calling in. There, Tony Jenkins, back to you on the issue of you know, the money that has been taken out of the, I guess, the advertising budget, if you will, for the Affordable Care Act. Do you find that, I mean, is Florida Blue having to chip in a little more to put your own adverts out there, your own commercials saying, here's what's happening, sign up now?
Well, I think that we're always making sure that we're educating consumers. We've got the right messages out there to separate fact from fiction. It is a challenge that the condensed period is where we're at.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I would say that we're still reaching out to all of our, not only our internal channels, but we've got external partners out there as well. So in addition to not necessarily a lot more increased our marketing or advertising budget, but we have increased and ramped up the partners that we've reached out to, provider offices,
mm-hmm.
And other groups out there to help us share and spread the word. For example, I'm going to be going to, over the next month, about 10 churches
mm-hmm.
In the area to be able to share information with their congregations to help spread the word out in other avenues as well.
That's interesting. Is that the first time you've done this?
You know, we try to make sure that we are very grassroots and very community-based. So even though we've gone out in those communities, we've done some things with various congregations. But again,
mm-hmm.
Anywhere where we can reach audiences to make sure that we have the opportunity to share the right information, we're going to look to do that.
Jody Ray, what does the reduced budget for getting the message out there about the Affordable Care Act, what does that mean for folks in your position? Are you, like, is that kind of a, putting you under a bit of a crunch?
Oh, sure. It was an unexpected, unfortunate series of events that has resulted in certainly fewer individuals on the ground. I mean, navigators, these are people who are going out into communities and working with folks where there are language barriers, there are transportation barriers, they're mobile, they're meeting people in their communities, they are speaking their languages, they come from the community, and, you know, that I think that helps. And has contributed to why such a program has been so successful in Florida, where the need has historically been so high because of our high rates of uninsured prior to the Affordable Care Act. You know, when you have less people to do that, it means there are people who may not have access to the kinds of assistance they need. I mean, we are seeing the schedules book up, which is encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
The response has been great, and I'm glad to see the word is getting out. I know we need to do more. We don't want to see some of those young adults get left behind. Like was mentioned, I think that's important. You know, getting kids, young adults into coverage now and utilizing the preventive care options that are included with the ACA means down the road they may be long-term healthy adults. Which certainly is a bonus to our healthcare system and our overall healthcare costs. So these are things we're really working on. We are continuing to reach, you know, all of the more vulnerable populations, and those are a lot of the people that end up coming in to see navigators
mm-hmm.
are people that need some really complex cases resolved and need a lot of assistance. So it's unfortunate. We also had to scale back some of the marketing and communication efforts.
Right.
We know getting the word out is important. The open enrollment dates have to resonate with consumers in every area of the state. So you're talking about maybe folks who digest information differently, and they're not watching healthcare debates on TV. So this is not top of mind until they really have to do something about their coverage. And that's the only time they think about it.
Right. 1-866-338-5252 is the number if you want to call in with a question or a comment. Maybe you're worried about your premiums going up because there has been a lot of talk about that, but a little bit of confusion perhaps about just how much you might end up paying out of pocket. 1-866-338-5252 is the number. You can also reach out to us on Twitter. We're at WMFE Orlando talking about the health insurance sign-up period under the Affordable Care Act kicks in next week. Are you getting ready to sign up? Do you have a plan already? Maybe you have some questions about the kind of coverage available. That number again, 1-866-338-5252. Abe Abarro, you know, we heard that premiums, you know, the increase is like 40% or maybe even more than that. But what does that actually mean for the people who are buying insurance?
So the average increase in Florida right now is 45%. But you have to remember, that is in reaction to the fact that the cost sharing reductions have gone away. They've been ended, and those are payments that go directly to insurance companies to help lower out of pocket costs. So these are, you know, deductibles, copays, what you're paying for a prescription. So the idea was basically that if you are low income, we don't want you to just have a plan that you can never use. They want it to be able to be something you can actually afford to go to the doctor with. So those went away. So the response is to increase the premiums. Well, the premium subsidies that you get from the government, if you're eligible for them, have not gone away. Those go up with the premium increases every year. So that means for most people, you're going to see a modest increase. Some people may even see, you know, might be paying a little bit less out of pocket potentially per year. Where this is going to have the biggest impact, though, is if you're making about 400% of poverty or higher. So if you're, you know, an individual making about $45,000-$47,000 a year, or a family of four making about $100,000, you're going to be paying the full cost of those premiums without subsidies. And so you are going to be seeing a big increase. And I think Tony's going to want to jump in here because, you know, we have seen examples where people are able to get a cheaper plan off of the market. And I'll let him talk about that.
Yeah, you're right, Abe, because there are a category of folks that did purchase the silver plan but didn't qualify for that subsidy. And one of the things that we didn't want to do was to have those individuals be hit and receive sticker shock by this large price increase. So what we've done is we've now developed plans off of the exchange, still ACA compliant, and we're encouraging these individuals to don't wait, because the worst thing that can happen is to do nothing, and then you're automatically enrolled into this high plan. And so we're doing our best to make sure that we know that those folks want to get with us, because we've created about 12 additional plans, similar benefits. Providers are probably still there for them to be able to then move to one of those low-cost plans.
I want to get a call in here. We've got Rick calling in from Orlando. Rick, what's on your mind thinking about health insurance?
Yeah, I had two quick questions. One is, do we know at this point what companies are going to be offering plans here in Florida, number one? And number two is, come November 1st, what is the best way to initiate this process of actually purchasing a plan? Is it through the marketplace itself? Is it through an insurance agent? Is it through a local agent or otherwise? Because I've done it in the past where I've actually dealt with the marketplace, somebody from the marketplace. They were fine, helpful, but I didn't know whether there was additional resources or research I could engage in to make a more informed decision. So those are the two questions. Do we know which plans are going to be available, what companies are going to insure through Obamacare this year, and what's the best way to initiate the actual decision-making process? Thank you.
Rick, thank you so much for your call. Jody, I'm going to throw that one to you. First of all, what is the best way to initiate this? You guys are boots on the ground. How do people go about signing up?
Just to be clear, I couldn't hear the question at all.
Okay, sorry. So the question was, what's the best way to go about signing up? There was another question there, but just if you want to tackle that first question.
Oh, easily. We have coveringflorida.org. Mm-hmm. You can go to coveringflorida.org. You can schedule with a navigator on your own, just entering in your zip code and get a navigator closest to you. And the schedules are all there. Or you can call 877-813-9115, and a navigator will pick up our number and schedule you with a navigator over the phone. So either way, it's really easy anywhere in the state to get access to a navigator in any of the communities around the state.
Jody, I know you've got to go soon, so I just wanted to get one more question in for you. You mentioned something before called the auto renewal. Just remind us what that is and what might happen if people aren't paying attention.
Right. So, this occurs each year. If there is a plan that is not going to be available next year and you're enrolled currently in that plan that is not going to be available, what the marketplace does is tries to place the consumer into what would be the most comparable plan of the plans that will be available in 2018. Mm-hmm. What is important about that is that it's going to occur at the end of open enrollment, and we want to make sure that people know that you really need to go through that window shopping process so that you know what your other options are going to be instead of waiting for the auto renewal, because then you might be in a position where you cannot change the plan that you have been auto renewed into. Mm-hmm. And rather than make a choice about a different plan that will be available.
Well, Jody Ray is the director of Florida Covering Kids and Families. Jody, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thank you.
I just want to get one more call in here real quick. We've got Debbie calling in from Orlando. Debbie, what was your question there?
My question was, my husband and I were fortunate enough to be able to enroll through the Affordable Health Care Act. Mm-hmm. I had a pre-existing condition, diabetes, which both of us had been without insurance for 2 years. The plan that was available through my husband's employment was mm-hmm. his total month, net income. So now we're on Medicare, and at the time that we enrolled, there were, in the state of Florida, 5 companies and about 98 plans. Mm-hmm. We were able to find one that we could afford, and we got the advanced tax credit. What I'm wanting to know now is my nephew, who is young and healthy, mm-hmm. He had a plan with Florida Blue, and then he became unemployed, and so he had to give up his plan. He's wanting me to help him enroll, the November 1st.
Right.
And I'm wanting to find out, first of all, will he be able to re-enroll? I think he hit Florida Blue before. Or if he can't, what plans, companies will be participating?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for your question, Debbie. I guess a quick, easy question for you there, Tony. Can somebody in that situation enroll?
So Debbie, depending on what area of the state he's in, what I'd love to do is get him in front of one of our retail center agents or one of our retail center customer service reps, because that's what we're there for. We've got 23 retail centers all around the state. It's best to get face-to-face with someone, especially it sounds like if he's had a Blue Cross Florida Blue plan before. And then that way we could go over the options, take a look at his income and other aspects that are going to make him qualify for a plan. So So that's one of the best options I could offer.
Last word to you.
Well, one of the things I would mention, when you're talking about Affordable Care Act plans, you can actually go 3 months without paying and still keep insurance coverage, which is great if you're a consumer. The problem you're going to run into, though, if you are in delinquency right now and you're trying to re-enroll and you're within that 3 months, you're going to have trouble re-enrolling without paying off the months that you're in right now. If that happened in January, you're going to be okay. But if it's happened right now, then you're probably going to have to pay that off or switch to a different company if there is one available.
Abab Rai, 90.7's healthcare correspondent, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Tony Jenkins, the market president for Florida Blue, thank you, Tony.
Sounds good. Have a good day.
And coming up next, how do you create a memorial to the victims who lost their lives at the Pulse nightclub? We have a conversation with Barbara Pomer coming up. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. How do you create a memorial to the victims who lost their lives at the Pulse nightclub? It's a process that takes time, and for Barbara Pomer, gathering as much input from the community as she can. Well, Barbara Pomer is the founder and owner of the Pulse nightclub. She's also the executive director of the One Pulse Foundation. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So earlier this month, you held a community forum which focused on the process of building a national museum and memorial for the nightclub. What was the takeaway for you from that conversation?
It was really wonderful to see so much of our community come out. So many people have actually watched it since then on WCF. So just seeing everybody's response was really inspirational.
Did you kind of have a sense of what you were going to hear from the audience going into that forum?
No, I had no idea the questions they were going to ask. And although I had known and met with the panelists, you know, I knew their backgrounds, but I had no idea what Orlando was going to ask.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is a big process, right? Like trying to design this memorial and encapsulate so much of what the nightclub meant and, you know, what the tragedy represents is quite a complex and tricky task. How does having a forum like that sort of help you shape what this memorial is going to be?
You know, I think it's really informational about the process. You know, I, of course, didn't know anything about how to create a memorial before the tragedy. So in my research, I just found out that all of the other memorials that were done around the country, you know, all had very similar processes, but very different outcomes. And that's just because every tragedy comes with its a different set of elements and space and demographics or wherever it was that, you know, specified to their tragedy. So, you know, we have no idea what's going ours is going to wind up looking like because it really just comes part of the data process.
So there have been some renderings released already. Just tell me about what those represent. Is this the temporary memorial?
Yes, the renderings that we've released are an interim memorial that will be there until the permanent memorial is designed and constructed. And that was really to clean up the site a little bit, to make it more respectable for the lives that were taken there, to give people a place to come and have some respite time and pay their respects.
You still have the iconic sort of plinth with the sign on it. It's a really nice looking design. I'm wondering, though, just because of the way it is, do you feel like people are still going to come and put their own messages or signs or what have you at that space once that interim memorial is designed and built?
Even with the interim design, we actually did design it so people could still leave messages and still bring items there. The actual Pulse sign will be encapsulated by polycarbonate panels, so people can actually write messages on that. That'll be a place for them to write. There'll be 4-inch walls that people can actually adhere or put flowers in or adhere gifts to or leave items there. So they will still be able to leave messages and leave gifts, but they'll also be a little closer to the building, be able to have some viewing points of the building. And it just seems to be that people want to be closer, and it would stop some of the people from trying to either look through the fence or go over the fence or under the fence.
So that's going to be a permanent wall, something a little more solid than what's there now?
Yes, the chain link fence will be gone. It's still it's a construction fencing, but it's made from wood, so it's still temporary.
And people will still be able to see the building through that?
There will be at a few points. There will be a break so that you can see through it.
You know, driving by it, you still see people congregating there, people sort of paying their respects. It's quite remarkable just the way that just hasn't stopped.
No, it hasn't stopped. You know, it does, you know, have ebb and flows in time of day or, you know, certain months that are people come, more people come than others. But it's still very busy. I mean, there are families there that still come when it's their loved one's birthday. You have people who just come down on their lunch hour, people who are traveling from out of the country or even in our country who are traveling here. So there's always someone there.
We had the Come Out with Pride parade in Orlando recently. Did you find that there were more people coming to visit the site of Pulse around that time?
It was very busy during Pride weekend. It definitely was.
So what do you think it is that makes designing the permanent memorial, that make this memorial unique and challenging?
I know that we have a smaller space than a lot of the other memorials that have been built, but designers and architects have a great way of knowing how to define that. So I think every space has its challenges.
Mm-hmm. And it will be at the same site?
Yes, it'll be on site.
So do you feel as though you're going to be able to satisfy everybody's needs from this memorial? You mentioned before that, you know, there are different, you know, communities involved. You've got the Latinx community, the LGBTQ community, the African-American community. Do you sort of go into this thinking it's going to be hard to satisfy everybody's needs from this?
I don't think, even in any memorial that has been built, that every single person affected was happy. I think that they all come to an agreeance and they're all part of the process. I think coming to the table and being part of the process is the most important mm-hmm. thing that anyone can do from every community that was affected. And that is why, you know, I wanted to talk about the survey, because the survey is online until October 31st, and that is the best way for anyone's voice to be heard right now about what happens there. And those questions are on that survey.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very simple. It takes 3 minutes, but it addresses all the different communities, all the different issues, the site, the building, and it is truly the most important thing that someone can do right now.
What sort of response have you had to that online survey so far?
We are close to 2,000 so far. Mm-hmm. We'd like to hear more voices than that. So I just encourage everyone to go to the website and take the survey.
Any thought to extending the deadline? I mean, is 2,000 enough? Were you expecting a little more input from the community on that survey?
I was hoping to get a little more. People usually say the last week you see the numbers grow dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hoping that they do. If not, we can try other ways to reach the community. But there was a lot of time and effort that went into making that survey from the task force. There were family members and survivors who were part of that process. So I hope that people will take the time to do that.
And have you been able to sort of look at some of the responses so far? Or is that kind of like a something that stays put until you actually finish the survey?
Yeah, I haven't seen any of the answers, and I won't see any of them until they're completely, the survey is closed and mm-hmm. the data has been compiled into a report that gets sent to us.
Are there going to be some more public forums, though, like the one you had a few weeks ago?
Yes, there will be other forums as we go through the process, especially when the design, the RFP gets announced and the design competition begins and the boards come in. So the community will be invited and involved as much as they want to be throughout the entire process.
How far along in that design process are we now? Like, what's the timeline looking like?
The survey is the first part.
Okay.
So once the survey closes, they will take the data from there and then they'll start building an RFP.
Do you have a sense from how other cities and communities have dealt with this, like how long that process can take?
I think once the RFP gets distributed and the design competition ensues, it's probably 9 months after that till design is selected. And then it's just about breaking ground and getting it built.
And there will be a competition for designers?
Yes.
As far as getting this built and paying for the construction, is that all coming out of the One Pulse Foundation?
Yes, mm-hmm. It will be. Mm-hmm. We have just we haven't quite launched our campaign for fundraising, but that should be happening very soon.
So the money that's in the One Pulse Foundation now, that's separate, or I mean, do you have to have a separate kind of fundraising campaign just for this memorial?
It's all one fund. We haven't begun to fundraise yet. The money that has been raised has been helping us start this process
mm-hmm.
and get the foundation start rolling and getting it built from the ground up.
I wanted to ask, too, Barbara Pomer, about your thoughts on a new location for a Pulse nightclub. I know you'd talked before about reopening in a different location. How is that process going?
It's moving along. You know, my husband and I have been searching for properties all around Orlando and certain, you know, sectors of Orlando. So we have identified a few places that are possible. Nothing definitive yet, but when it's time, it'll come.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that's something that you don't approach that lightly, right? That's
no.
Probably something, and I'm assuming that you might have to put as much thought into that as you're putting into the construction, the design of this memorial.
That's true. And so it's hard to do both of those things simultaneously. My husband is my partner in that area. That's what he does very well. He's done that for us all of our married lives. So he will find the right location and he knows what it's going to take to make it right.
Finally, Barbara Pomer, how are you doing in all of this?
I'm doing okay. You know, I still just take it day by day. Some days better than others. The process keeps me very busy, which keeps my mind very occupied. And that's how I'm going to keep going.
Barbara Pomer, founder and owner of the Pulse Nightclub and executive director of the One Pulse Foundation, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And if you want to take part in the online survey about the design of the Pulse Memorial, you can find details on the One Pulse Foundation website. This week, UCF President John C. Hitt announced his retirement. He spent more than 25 years leading the university and he'll step down next year. I interviewed Dr. Hitt back in March. He reflected on the growth of the university. The university has grown considerably since you first started. I think it was some 22,000 students when you first got there.
Just short of that, yes.
It's now almost tripled in size. Could you have predicted just how big the university would get when you started out here?
Matthew, I don't think I could have. I knew it would be a lot bigger than it was. Not that many months after I got here, I came upon a memo that said we would have, I think it was 48,000 students by 2000 or something like that. It probably wasn't 2000, probably 2010 or something. But at any rate, whatever the number was, it recalibrated my thinking. I said, my gosh, you know, this is pretty well done work. And, you know, when you're talking about something that happens in, say, 18 years, like a kid is born and goes to college, you can get pretty good prediction. Mm-hmm. And so that adjusted my mental processes a bit, and we started taking a little more seriously the thought that we would have to deal with 40,000-plus students.
Hess also spoke about the new downtown campus, which broke ground this year.
Well, you know, you'd like every project to go as smoothly as you could envision, but they seldom do. And I think this, considering where it is, you know, downtown, apart from the main campus, the funding was a little complex. Depending for good neighbors in the city to come up with a third of the money, I think it's gone pretty well, and I feel good about it.
Was it important for you to stick around as president of the university to see that groundbreaking and to see the campus actually completed, if that's what happens?
Well, it would be nice, but there'll always be something. You know, in a university the size of UCF, there'll always be a project of some significance. So you just have to accept that when the time comes to go, you're going to go, because if you wait until there's not a significant project, you may go out feet first.
That was UCF President John Hitt speaking to Intersection back in March. He announced his retirement this week. Still to come, an opera that was once performed in a concentration camp during World War II comes to the stage in Orlando. We talk to the young performers putting on Brundabar when Intersection returns. Don't miss a minute of Intersection. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. You can listen on the NPR One app, and you can find us online at WMFE.org. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. You're listening to the Victory March from the opera Brundabar. Brundabar was first performed by children in a concentration camp during World War II. Now the Orlando Opera Youth Company and the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra are bringing the opera to the stage here in Orlando. Well, joining me in the studio to talk more about the opera is Terrence Hunter. He coordinates cultural events at the Holocaust Center. Terrence, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Also joined by Hannah Loper. She's a singer with the Opera Orlando Youth Company. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Anna Horsen. She's the concertmaster for the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra. Anna, thank you as well.
Thank you.
So, Terrence, start us off. What is this opera about?
So Brundabar tells the story of two children who go to town to get milk for their sick mother. And the town bully Brundabar prevents them from doing so. So they feel that initially they can gather the milk, the money for the milk by singing, and Brundabar thwarts their efforts. So mm-hmm. the townspeople work together to defeat Brundabar.
Now, the opera has an interesting history, right? It was written by somebody who was imprisoned in a concentration camp, a Czech composer named Hans Krása, and it was performed in that concentration camp. Tell me a little bit about the history of the performance of this opera.
So Brundabar was composed in 1938 for a competition that was taking place in 1939, but it was never submitted for the competition because of the war. So the composer was imprisoned in Terezin, in the camp where it was performed 55 times. And while he was there, he recomposed it for the kids in the camp. He sort of became their cultural director of sorts. And so as the kids performed this piece, the defeat of Brundabar came to symbolize the defeat of Hitler.
They were allowed to perform this? Was this like a secret performance? What was the story there?
So they were allowed to perform it openly. The guards would look on, and somehow or another, they never caught on to the fact of who Brundibar came to symbolize.
Mm-hmm. And was it written in Czech, I'm assuming?
Yes.
What about the production now?
It will be performed in English.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me bring in you in this conversation, Hannah Loper. Tell me about the part you play in the opera.
I play the ice cream man. It's kind of just a passing role that doesn't seem as important, but it really kind of speaks to the time frame and the kind of people that were there and how, like, well, there's also a milkman and, like, how if you buy milk, you can use the milk to heal your parent or whatnot. And mm-hmm. So it was kind of like they couldn't afford medicine and stuff like that, so they would go for other things.
How much did you have to learn about the history of the opera and the history of the time period it was set to kind of get ready for this role?
I mean, you have to learn a lot because you don't appreciate it unless you know as much as you can about it, because you won't be able to portray it to its fullest ability and you can't interact with everybody else correctly mm-hmm. unless you know that it is actually a significant character.
Now, you're singing alto for this role. Tell me a little bit about that part. Is it something that you normally sing, that range?
I normally kind of just go wherever they need somebody because... I mean, you always have more sopranos than you have altos. So, mm-hmm.
And some of your other performances include the likes of Midsummer Night's Dream, Hairspray, Les Miserables. How does this production compare to some of the other operas you've performed in?
It's kind of like, well, like when you do Les Mis, of course, that also speaks to a very big time in history that was very substantial for other people. And this kind of contrasts because this is even bigger and even more emotional and even speaks more to a different time frame. So it's definitely probably going to be the hardest show that I've ever done emotionally, even mm-hmm. if itself doesn't come across as depressing and as emotionally pulling as Les Mis or something like that. It's still, you have to be able to put that significance in it, which is mm-hmm. going to be probably more difficult than other plays that I would have done.
Does it feel like there's some responsibility to playing the part the way the composer intended, or just given the historical significance of it? Is there more significance to this role than maybe some of the others you've done?
I think the fact that it was performed so many times by people that were in concentration camps, it gives you more of a need to make it a very profound character, even if it doesn't seem that important to that kid. Whoever played that role, it was very significant because mm-hmm. that was probably one of the best things that they had at the time, because I mean I'm also in Videm, which is like somebody who did those plays also wrote with him. And you kind of see how much those affected the lives of all of the children. Every little part of it mm-hmm. was very much an effect on their lives.
So you're really thinking about the people who are originally performing this as you're singing.
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, I don't know how you can play it without imagining that. It's just this play, this music, this opera would not have any need if it wasn't for the children who played those roles.
Anna Horsen, describe the music for us. What does it sound like?
Interestingly, it's not what I originally expected it to be. When you think of the Holocaust, you think of darker ideas of music and phrases and such. But it's actually lighter. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say it's more like Mozart, but it has a lighter feeling, a happy feeling. And once you think about it, it makes more sense. Because within that time period of performing Brundibar, like the length of the opera, the people in the audience, they're watching it to escape from everything else that is going on within that concentration camp.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes more sense, the musical being light. So it was unexpected, but it makes a lot more sense now.
Do you have a favorite piece or a favorite movement from the opera?
I do not at the moment. I think the ending is very fun to play, mostly because there's a lot of really fast notes and it's challenging.
Mm-hmm.
But we have not yet been able to rehearse with the opera and the opera company. So I feel that once we're able to do that and see exactly what's going on as we're playing, that I'll eventually develop a favorite part of the music.
Right, because this is a little different from a regular performance for the orchestra. You're having to sort of think about what the singers are doing as well. Just how complex is that live performance going to be, do you think?
I have played in pit orchestras before, and the hardest thing, I think, is not to watch the people. So when you're rehearsing, yes, it's very important to watch the opera performers, because to get a sense of the opera, but during the performance. You can't watch because you have to be watching the conductor and make sure you're in on time. Mm-hmm. And it's like that, yes.
So you've just got your head down concentrating on your job.
Yes, yes, because mm-hmm. it's very important to not get behind, because if you miss getting in, then
the wheels could fall off.
Yes.
So what's it like being the concertmaster for the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra? What does that role involve?
The role involves having to know your music and being responsible for knowing everyone's parts, knowing when people are supposed to come in. I'm also the person who is always watching the conductor, making sure the orchestra is always together on the beats. And I feel that I'm the communicator among sections. So just last week, it was our conductor's birthday. Mm-hmm. And so Miss Heidi, our coordinator, she told me that she wanted the orchestra to play Happy Birthday for them, for Mr. Clausen. And so I had to go to each section and talk to the section leaders and communicate that we wanted to do it as a surprise. Mm-hmm. So I think that's a big part of my job as concertmaster, is really knowing music and being able to communicate among the sections.
How did that performance go off?
It actually went really well. I was very happy.
Mm-hmm. And how long have you been in the Florida Youth Orchestra for?
This will be my 12th season. Wow. So it's been long. I started playing violin when I was 4, and I started playing in FSYO 2 years later when I was 6.
So you're a mentor for some of the younger players?
I'd like to think I am, yes. Mm-hmm.
What about your role with the Orlando Opera Company, Hannah Loper? Just looking at your resume, you've got a long list of performances there. How long have you been singing for them?
Well, I'm the intern. I've been the intern for the past year. This is my second year. This will be my 6th or 7th year with them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How's that going?
It's going pretty well. It's very interesting to see how it's developed over time, because this is our first complete opera and our first collaboration with FSYO. Mm-hmm. So it's very exciting to see that this is going to be the first choice that we pick. Mm-hmm. The first opera that we decide to do is going to be this one.
Terrence, I want to bring you back into the conversation. Just reading about the history of this opera, Tess Wise, the founder of the Holocaust Center, wanted to put a performance on way back in 2001. That didn't happen. So 16 years later, this opera is going to be performed. How significant is that for the Holocaust Center?
It is incredibly significant. Tessa's dream was to fly in the Israeli Children's Opera and perform this piece around the state. So she worked with opera companies in Jacksonville and Tampa and Sarasota. 16 years later, we're not quite doing it on that scale, but to bring it to this stage in Orlando where it has not been performed before is still incredibly significant, especially given all that this piece represents.
If it's a success, are there some plans down the track to take it on tour, do you think?
I don't believe so. Not on behalf of the Holocaust Center. Mm-hmm. It has been performed recently in Miami and Sarasota.
Okay. And where can people see it? When and where can people see the performance?
So the performance is Sunday, November 5th at the Rosen JCC, which is on Apopka Vineland Boulevard. Tickets are available on the Holocaust Center's website. The performance will begin at 2 p.m. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be a two-part performance, half Brundabar and the other half with Vadim, with Lori Leitman.
Well, Terrence Hunter coordinates cultural events at the Holocaust Center. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Hannah Loper, who sings with the Opera Orlando Youth Company. Thank you so much, Hannah.
Thank you.
And Anna Horsen, who is the concertmaster for the Florida Symphony Youth Orchestra. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. Our intern is Alana Campbell. Production assistance for this week's show from Abe Abaraya. If you appreciate the interviews and the reporting you hear on Intersection, consider making a contribution to 90.7 during our silent drive. Click on over to our website, wmfe.org, or call 1-800-785-2020. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.